The topic, as you know, is the question what this world needs most. And it is a question in a sense. And perhaps when that question is asked, well, the answer seems to be so varied, because you say it depends upon where in the world that you are. For we live in a world that is saturated with needs that stagger the mind. If we would go this morning to that country that was formerly Yugoslavia, where the people are dying, innocent children, mothers, as well as men, and we would say, well, that part of the world needs peace more than anything else. Or if we were to go south from Europe into the great continent of Africa, into the country of Somalia, and I'm sure that your heart has been wrenched as mine has as we've looked at the pictures of little children with distended stomachs and with that gaunt look that is evident as a result of malnutrition that has affected their mental capabilities. And we would say, well, the greatest need there is food. If you could go with me to Bangladesh, the country that my wife and I spent a little more than 2.5 years in, a very fertile but flat country that has lots of water but doesn't know how to control it. And we would say, well, the greatest need there is development. Our own country, I suppose we would say the greatest need would be unity. Or if we were to go into some of the cancer or AIDS wards in our country, and some would say, well, the greatest need is that of health, that of healing. But what this world needs most of all is love. A love that is demonstrated. And the world is dying for the demonstration of that love. Dr. Millen, in a book written a number of years ago entitled None of These Diseases, makes this statement: love is as essential to happiness and to mental health as food is to our physical well-being. The need of love and the need of demonstrated love. According to research, that there's a difference in the age span of those who are elderly who go into nursing homes at the close of their lives. There are those who are visited regularly, and there are those who seem to be forgotten. Family is dead, friends are dead, or they are neglected by family. And statistics tell us that on the average, a person, an elderly senior citizen who is loved, who is cared for, who is visited, lives on the average 6 years longer than those who are neglected. And where is love to be found? It should be found in our homes. And yet we know that in this day, when homes are breaking up, as they are, almost 50% of marriages that take place today will not last, and there will be a breakup before there should be. There is constant bickering in many homes, and there is little demonstration of love in many others. And so many homes, it's not found. What about the church? People have a right to expect love within the church, because, after all, the church was founded upon love. And yet, all too often, it is not found there either. Perhaps you have heard the story, in fact I know some of you have, about the young man who was walking down the sidewalk and he passed a bookstore. And he was, at that particular time of life as a young man, he was thinking romantically. And there in the window was a book that was entitled How to Hug. He stopped immediately and went in and said, I'll buy it. He didn't bother looking at it. And he got home, and to his dismay and frustration, he found it was one volume of an encyclopedia, a How to Hug. And we find that the church, you got that, did you? Ray Stedman, who is noted for his influence in what was known as the body life movement a number of years ago, says that too often people have come to church looking for love, and all they've discovered has been an encyclopedia of theology. And there's nothing wrong with that. We need theology, because theology is information about God and about His greatness. And yet we can be correct. We can be icily correct in our theology. And if people come in and that's all they get without the demonstration and without the feeling of love that is manifested towards them, something is very much missing. And we remind ourselves this morning that one of the most prominent, if not the prominent theme of scriptures, and I know that there are many sides to this aspect, but one of the most prominent themes is certainly that of love. The golden text of the Bible, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son." God loved and God gave. And when we read the pages of the New Testament stresses its importance. 1 Timothy 1:5, "The end of our endeavor is love, out of a pure heart, out of a good conscience." It's true. 1 Peter 4:8, "Above all, love each other deeply." And then it goes on to say, "For love shall cover a multitude of sins." And the chapter that we have before us that I would like us to look at this morning, or part of it at least, because we cannot deal with all of it by any means, but we have here a manual for the demonstration to tell us how to demonstrate love, both by Christians for Christians as well as by Christians for those who may be still in the world, both within and without of the church. If you look at verse 9, where Bill started to read, we have the biblical, or the quality of biblical love. Simply stated in the NIV translation, love must be sincere. It was only a week or two ago that Pastor Thurton referred to this word sincere in a different context, and I remind ourselves of it. The word sincere itself comes from the two Latin words sincera, which means without wax. And the Roman sculptor in that day would take a piece of granite or a piece of marble, I suppose, more than granite, and would fashion a statue. And in so doing, he hoped that that statue would be perfect, that there would be no cracks in it. But sometimes something would happen and that piece of statue would become cracked. And of course, the value plummeted when there was a crack in it. And so he would take wax. He would color it to the same color and the texture of the marble and fit it into that crack so that a non-suspecting customer would look at the statue, would think that it was perfect, and would get it home only to discover that there was wax. And so a person, when he bought a statue, wanted to be sure that it was without wax. There are a number of ways this particular verse has been translated. One is, "Let love be without hypocrisy." Another translator has put it, "Love must be genuine." And to put it in other words, let us have no imitation of love, but let it be the genuine article. We've, in our Sunday school class, or the Sunday school class I've been teaching, have been looking at Matthew 22:37-40. Where Jesus says the first and the greatest commandment is to love God. But what does it mean to love God? Most of us have heard the name Charles Colson. He was Richard Nixon's hatchet man a number of years ago and implicated in the Watergate fiasco, which to those of you who are younger doesn't mean very much. But Charles Colson was implicated in the Watergate scandal, was sentenced to jail, and as a result of that, God worked in his life, and he has become an outstanding Christian and a servant for the Lord. A number of years ago, he tells of how that he wondered what it meant in practical terms to love God. And he began to ask those that he felt were mature Christians, what does it mean to love God? And he got some different answers and some conflicting answers and some confused answers. He said, one man said, well, I guess with all my heart, soul, and mind. Somebody said, he went on, I guess by having a worshipful attitude, by being an acceptable sacrifice, by maintaining a devotional schedule, I guess I better do some more thinking about this. Others said, it involved about faithful church attendance. With others, it was that they were no longer committing the favorite sins that they had been delivered from. And others spoke of love as being something of a romantic nature, the way that they felt towards God. And so the conclusion that Charles Colson reached was that most of us don't know what it means to love God. And if we don't know what it means to love God, then how can we do it? And out of that conclusion, he wrote the book in 1983, or I think it was published in 1983, Loving God, and I can recommend it to you. And rather than it being a manual telling us how to love God, he has given to us the accounts of a number of people who demonstrated their love for God by the things that they did. For Romans 12 shows us that love is not an emotional word, as we sometimes think of it, although it contains the emotional component, but love is an action word. And it indicates how we as believers are, the Romans 12 portion, you could take all of the chapter, but I'm starting at verse 9. As I said before, it's a manual indicating how we as believers are to demonstrate love both to fellow believers and to those outside the church. And interestingly enough, in the latter part of Matthew chapter 25, Jesus indicates that as we demonstrate this love to other people, in reality, we are loving God. Notice in verse 9, as we go on, love must be sincere, the quality. We notice another thing about love, that it rejects sin, but not the sinner. Hate that which is evil, cling to that which is good. Now this could have to do, and one interpretation would be, that it has to do with evil things. Hating that which is evil in that sense, and clinging to that which is good. But it also has another interpretation, which I would like to dwell on this morning. It's talking, or could be talking, about the redeemed, about redeemed people, Christians who have slipped. We need to remember that Christians are not perfect people. They are forgiven people. And I read the words of Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. Brothers, and he could have put sisters there just as well, if someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore him gently, but watch yourself, or you also may be tempted. And then he goes on to say, bear you one another's burdens, and it's in this context, the burden of other people's sins and mistakes, and thus fulfill the law of Christ. And the law of Christ is the law of love. For Jesus said, a new commandment I give to you, and that commandment is that you love one another. I remember a bit of doggerel that my mother taught me years ago. I've never forgotten it. And it went something like this. There's so much good in the worst of us and so much bad in the best of us that it ill behooves the rest of us to criticize any of us. And there's a lot of truth in that. And even as Christian people, we find we're subject to temptation, and we can slip and we can fall and we can fail. And Paul says that we are to separate the sin of the fallen believer from the individual. God does that with us. And we find it very difficult to do that with individuals. We somehow tie the sin that a person may be guilty of with the individual. Hypocritical love doesn't accept a person unless he conforms. And how many of us have put down the believer who has sinned and who has slipped, rather than having tried to lift them up? How often have we forgotten that Jesus said in Luke chapter 15, for the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost. And we forget that. Warren Wiersbe, the speaker on Back to the Bible Hour for a number of years, wrote these words, the church is the only army that shoots its wounded. And we know of the ambulance corps in our armies, and we know the willingness of men to put themselves in danger as they go out to retrieve those who have fallen in battle and who are wounded, to bring them in. And yet sometimes I feel that we as a church don't do a very good job of that. Especially depending on what the wound is. There are certain sins that are respectable. Dale Ryan, a Baptist minister in the States, set up within his particular church a number of recovery groups. And these are very popular in some areas. Groups that, of course, we've had Alcoholics Anonymous for a number of years. And so he set up a number of groups for those who were coming out of childhood abuse, for those that were coming out of drugs, for those that were coming out of a homosexual lifestyle. And he was interviewed by Christianity Today. And the question was, do you find that there is much resistance in the church to these groups? And he said, well, it depends upon the type of group that it is. That there are certain sins that seem to be less respectable in the eyes of a respectable, quote, church. And so he said the group that has been established for helping homosexuals to get out of their lifestyle is sort of looked down on. And there's resistance. And so we ask the question, does the world see love, acceptance, and compassion demonstrated within our church? Or is there rejection, prejudice, and contempt? And I want you to know that as associate pastor here at the Markham Missionary Church, I trust that if you are struggling with something, if you have fallen, and you're afraid that you will be put down if you come to me to share the area of a fall, if you mean business, I want you to know that you will not be shown contempt in any way. But I would also say, don't fool with me either. We need to be honest. And there are some who are not honest and who are not up front concerning the needs that they have. And I talked about this in the Sunday school class this morning. For God can only help a person who honestly faces up to a situation as it is within his or her life. But if a person is honest and wants deliverance from whatever it is, I want you to know that you can count upon my wholehearted support. The supreme mark of the life of Jesus Christ within the Christian is, of course, love. Love that accepts others as they are, is tender-hearted, forgiving, and seeks to prevent misunderstanding and differences of opinion from divisions from dividing one Christian against the other. We must hasten on. I'm only going to touch on very few of these this morning, for our time is almost up. Verse 10. True love regards others as more deserving than self. Honor one another above yourselves. J.B. Phillips translates that as be willing to let other people have the credit. And then I remember a motto I came across years ago that said there is no limit to the good that a person can do if he doesn't care who gets the credit. And we as pastors need to be very careful for that. With that. We're only links in the chain, cogs in the wheel. A pastor preached a message one Sunday, and there was an altar call, and an individual came forward to accept the Lord, and so he asked afterwards, what part of my sermon was it that influenced you to make this decision? And she said, Pastor, it wasn't anything you said. It was, and she mentioned one obscure Christian in the congregation who lived the Christian life in such a way that that person was convicted. We don't need the credit. We need to be willing. We mustn't take it to ourselves, that which really belongs to the Lord. Verse 11. Genuine love retains enthusiasm despite of setbacks. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. This is in the face of discouraging situations. And it's true that people will let you down. And I have said, it's impossible for me to be discouraged. Of course, that's my ideal. But I've been let down. I've seen the church let down in different areas. And my heart has been breaking. Sometimes I've been angry. And then I come back to the fact that it's God's work. And all that God requires of me and all that he requires of you, regardless of how many people let us down, is that we be faithful. God did not call us to be successful. He called us to be faithful. And we need to remember, even as David reminded the soldiers back when Israel was fighting against the Philistines. And remember, David went to the front with some care packages for his brothers who were in the army. And he discovered that things were at a standstill. Goliath, the great Philistine giant, was challenging the people and the army was fearful. And David said, "Who is this uncircumcised Philistine who dares defy the armies of the living God? The battle is not ours, but the Lord's." And realizing this, we can maintain our enthusiasm, knowing that the battle is the Lord's. And he is sovereign. And someday he's going to win. Oh, there may be some skirmishes that will be lost. But the battle is God's, not ours. And you and I can be enthusiastic and not lose our zeal. And then true love, and we notice this in verse 12, responds to human needs. Verse 12, share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. A number of you were able to do that last Sunday evening. But I want to focus on the need aspect. Needs may be physical, emotional, or they may be spiritual. And we are entrusted by Christ to carry on the work which he began. Remember, he said, "As the Father has sent me, even so send I you." What was Jesus to do? Well, we can't carry on his work of redemption. That is impossible. But I read Jesus' own statement of why the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. Luke chapter 4, 18 to 19. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed and proclaim the year of our Lord's favor." That's what Jesus was to do. He doesn't talk about his redemption, his redeeming aspects there. And so you and I are to meet physical needs, and we took up an offering to do that around the world today. Spiritual needs, by being in prayer for those who have spiritual needs and by being available. I'm glad for organizations. I'm glad for these groups that I referred to that are being established in different parts of the Christian church to help people with specific needs. I mean, that's meeting needs, those who are in need. I'm glad for parachurch ministries or organizations such as New Directions for Life to enable people, Christians, who have come to the realization that they've been bound by a lifestyle that is not according to God's word. But there is help. That's following in love this particular exhortation. And emotional needs. That's by us being available and sensitive to those who are around us. Verse 15, and this is going to be as far as I can go and probably too far, but we'll share it with you. Love is an action word that needs to be communicated. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. That takes communication. It demonstrates that we love. Do we communicate love? What about within our own homes, within our own families? Do we do it? I read from Smalley's book just this last week something that caused Joy and I to laugh one night as we went over it, of a lady who saw new neighbors move into the house across the street that had been vacant. And she was curious as to what kind of people they were, and so she watched each evening as father would get home from work. And when he got out of the car, his wife went running out to meet him, and they hugged and they kissed, and he usually had a gift or some flowers of some kind to give her. And the next night, after she saw it the first night, she looked out again, and sure enough, it was the same thing all over again. And for a couple of weeks she watched. And she wasn't used to that sort of thing, and so she couldn't keep quiet any longer. When her husband came home this particular night, as he was coming in, she said, "Did you know we have new neighbors across the street?" And as he threw his briefcase down and slouched into his easy chair in front of the TV set, he grunted, "I know." She said, "Do you know what they do every evening when he comes home?" "No, I don't know. What do they do?" She said, "Well, almost every evening he has a gift or flowers that he gives her, and they hug and kiss until the door closes behind them. Why don't you do that?" And with a puzzled look, he said, "I couldn't do that. I don't even know the woman." Do we communicate to those we should the fact that we really care for them, that we really love them? Do we talk to people at church that we should? Do we reach out in love? And we need to demonstrate it in the church. We need to demonstrate it to each other, and the world will be impressed. Don Bubna, who wrote the book Building People Through Caring Fellowships, says, "No matter how fine the preaching, nor how adequate the programs, no church can claim to be spiritual if its people are not talking together. A church that is learning to greet one another warmly as the Bible commands communicates the love of God. We rejoice with those who rejoice, and we can't do that unless we know them. And we're to mourn with those who are passing through deep waters, those who are ill." And we extend our sympathy this morning to Marion in the passing of her father this past week. And there are others who are going through difficult times. And I know that I'm guilty of not being as alert and as sensitive as I should be, and I want to improve. How do we comfort those who mourn? Joe Bailey, who lost three children, and I've referred to him before, tells how to and how not to. He said, "I was sitting torn by grief. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly. He said things that were true. I was unmoved except to wish he would leave, and he did. Another came and sat beside me. He did not talk. He didn't ask leading questions. He just sat beside me for an hour, listened when I said something, and answered briefly, prayed, and left. I was moved. I was comforted. I was sorry to see him go." We communicate by talking, but we communicate sometimes in silence with the language of a heart of love. The last part of the chapter deals with not seeking revenge, of living peaceably with all men as much as depends upon us. We're not responsible for the other person, but I am responsible for what I do. He says, be careful to do what is right in the sight of everybody. That is, live a life of integrity. Live in harmony with one another and seek no revenge. In fact, instead of seeking revenge, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, and in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. I didn't understand what that meant for a long time. And then I read about how that in the old days, there weren't matches, of course, or butane lighters or whatever, and so that fire was kept going. And if somebody's fire went out, they went to a neighbor, and they received live coals that were put in an earthen container, and there was a pad on the head, and this was carried home on the head. Doing good, reaching out, helping others. This is how to get rid of your enemies. You don't have to shoot them to get rid of them. But you can get rid of them, some of them at least, by turning them into friends. I may have told this story before, but I use it in closing. I heard Alan Redpath tell this many years ago in the Hill Conference that I referred to from time to time. And he told of how an individual was sharing how that he had come to know Christ, and he said it was through an army buddy. He said, I was a typical soldier. I was godless. I was going my own way. I had no use for the things of God. And in my regiment, in my platoon, there was a Christian. And he used to bother me so much. Didn't bother me so much by what he said, but by the way he lived. He didn't enter into the things that I did, that most of us did. Instead of going to the bars and the other places, he would stay home. He would take time to read the Bible. And at night, he always knelt beside his bunk, the lower one. And he said, I hated him for it. And he said, one night I came in late. We'd been carousing. We'd been on the town. And he said, there he was. He was on his knees beside the bed. And he said, I took my heavy army boot off and I heaved it at him and it hit him. He didn't do anything. He didn't flinch. And then he said, I took my other boot and I threw it at him and it also hit him and he didn't do anything. And he said, I was pretty well drunk. And he said, I got into bed and the morning came and reveille. And I thought, oh, where are my boots? And he said, with shame, he said, I went over towards his bed to look for them, but they weren't there. And then he said, I realized that my boots were beside my bed with the best shine that I'd ever seen on them. And he said, that was probably the most important factor in bringing me to know Christ. Well, what does it mean to love? It means to put into action the things that we know we ought to. It's to be accepting. It's to be reaching out.